Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002, and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com if you're online. This week, local writer and poet Roger Yates. He's also an anarchist, and he's written a book called The Beautiful Season, a history of the Spanish Civil War. So I'm talking to him about that. Also, Angela Balassi interviews me, grills me, in fact, about the European Union. What's its origins? How democratic is it in the run-up to the referendum? Also, Britain's first black broadcaster, Alex Pascal, used to run a phone-in on Radio London in the 1970s and 1980s. A second part of an interview with him this week, where he talks about his encounter on the radio with Peter Tosh. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. You can call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. You can call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show.
My name's Roger Yates. I'm 72. I've written all my life. I come from a generation of the British beat poets. I suppose the most famous of our group was Lee Harwood, Chris Torrance, Barry McSweeney, those people back in the 60s. So we were in this kind of little mag scene. So I've published in that.
But there's not much of a little magazine scene around anymore, is there? So there's poets out there, but they're not necessarily getting into print.
Yeah, I think so, although they're probably perhaps publishing online and or they have blogs. There's quite a powerful poetry scene, I think, in Bristol. There are poetry readings. I don't ever get involved with it myself.
What were you writing about in the 60s and 70s then?
We were writing poetry. We just naturally felt that we were poets. Poetry was the rock and roll of that period, really.
Well, I suppose it managed to find its way into song lyrics and all sorts of things, didn't
it?
But
yes,
what was your muse? What were you kind of, you know, what was your inspiration?
Well, personally, people like T.S. Eliot and Shakespeare and high culture poetry, but we were also writing within the kind of context of the Beat Generation, people like Allen Ginsberg. That group.
Gary Snyder, Jack
Gary
Kerouac.
Snyder, exactly, yeah. And Jack Kerouac, yeah.
And, but I mean, they were writing a lot, I think it's fair to say, a lot about social change and social justice because the 60s, the Summer of Love, I mean, is that where you were too?
In a way, yes, but I suppose I stepped back towards... Towards the Beat Generation, really.
Yes, I suppose the Beat Generation is before all that.
Oh, no, I was never a very good hippie.
Post-war, more post-war than 60s, or not?
Well, perhaps some artier is the point. The hippies were rock and roll people. My generation were listening to jazz. We were listening to John Coltrane. We were listening to Charles Mingus. I personally felt that rock and roll was... corporate music. I got into rock and roll really with the Beatles. In funny circumstances, I was living in Macau in a hotel.
Where's that?
Macau. It's opposite Hong Kong. It's on the Chinese mainland. It's now part of China, but it was a Portuguese colony. So I was living there and listening every day, all day, to A Hard Day's Night by the Beatles, being played by a little girl selling orange juice down below my hotel.
So you were weaned onto
onto the Beatles.
Rock and roll.
I was weaned onto rock and roll by a Chinese girl, yeah.
Amazing. So I think for those that haven't really come across the Beat Generation much, because it certainly isn't really being acknowledged as important as it was you know, I think the impact that it had at the time isn't now. What was it about? What was the Beat? What made someone part of the Beat Generation?
That's kind of difficult to say. I suppose it was most simply, I mean, it was the thing that was happening. Writers like William Burroughs were very important. And so On the Road, of course, by Jack Kerouac, which I think is a truly awful book, and I'm very unpopular with my old Beat friends for saying so. But I mean, it did have a big impact, you know. It was a kind of poetic dystopia. There was something very unique in that.
But it was definitely an antidote to the sort of settled lifestyle, everything being nice and clean cut, reliable income every week, a sort of American dream style home, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, that's what it set out. That's what it said it was doing, yeah. But I think it's actually a very, very conservative book, On the Road. All about America, after all.
Yeah, but I mean, that's where he was. It's difficult for him to write about Kerouac, to write about other places when that's where he's you know, experiencing a lot of things that are going on. I mean, he was part of a scene over there which was very much to do with the experimenting with drug culture and challenging social norms.
Yes, it was. Yes.
What was the equivalent? Was there an equivalent in Britain?
Yes, absolutely, definitely. In fact, if you think about it, Bob Dylan came really to Britain as to the source when he wanted to discover our folk music scene. So Britain was quite important in that kind of way. Whether we actually had we had the writers, you know. And but then they weren't so famous or, you know, as the American writers were, particularly people like Ginsberg, Corso, that lot.
So more recently you've been writing a book, first of all, I think, one you published last year, is The Beautiful Season, the story of the Spanish Revolution,
yes.
A story of the Spanish Revolution.
Yes.
What's that about?
It's about the Spanish Revolution.
Oh, yes.
But in
the Civil War?
No, I mean, I think there's a difference. I'd seen a very marvelous documentary called Living Utopia. It's in Spanish, but it's well subtitled. It's got marvelous music, flamenco music and Spanish music. It was interviews with the anarchists of the Spanish Revolution of 1936 when they were all in their 80s, maybe. And it was truly inspiring. I mean, I knew about the Spanish Civil War, as we call it. I knew there'd been an anarchist revolution, but I knew very little about it. And so I ended up reading histories and just getting into the subject for about 6 months. I read a lot of stuff. And then, suffering from insomnia, I got up one night at 2 o'clock and started writing. And I finished the book more or less in one draft. It is in one draft, actually, in 3 weeks and 2 days.
Okay, so that's in less than a month. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen the Ken Loach film Land and Freedom about the Spanish Revolution, Civil
yes.
War, whatever you want to call it. But it did seem that the anarchists at the end of the Civil War the Revolution, were stitched up. So
yes,
they didn't
absolutely.
Actually get their revolution. So
they
aspired to have a revolution.
Quite.
But as so often happens,
yes.
The dreams were dashed at the last minute.
Well, they were dashed before the last minute.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, the revolution was betrayed by absolutely everybody. But what I wanted to write about, I mean, the Civil War, I've said it in that book, and it's perhaps it's a point of view, but the Civil War was really a fight, and this is a right-wing point of view, unfortunately. It was a fight between Stalin and the fascists. If the Republic, who everybody fates as being, for democracy, that old story, if the Republic had won, there would have been a Stalinist dictatorship in Spain. And if, as Franco won, there was a fascist dictatorship in Spain. So it made very little difference. The story that was interesting was the fact that the workers rose up in 1936, and they actually precipitated, if you like, the Spanish Civil War, because it's my view that that Franco would have taken Spain in 2 or 3 weeks. He was absolutely unopposed. The army and the police were all going over to Franco. The government had collapsed, and into this power vacuum, and this always happens. The same thing has happened, for example, in Syria with the Rojava Kurds in the absence of government. The same thing happened in the subject of my second book, which is the Paris Commune. You know, when government disappears, people rise up and very effectively manage things for themselves. And that's what happened in Spain, although it has to be said, there was a huge anarchist movement, millions of people in syndicalist trade unions, the CNT, CNT. They'd been practicing for this for 20 years. So they literally took over northern Spain very, very quickly, drove the army out, and collectivized in a way that never happened in the Soviet Revolution. Nothing like that happened. They completely collectivized. In many places, they did away even with money. Orwell was there. The book to read, don't read my book, read read Homage to Catalonia, which is a very, very marvelous book. Orwell was there slightly after the period that I write about. I write about the 4 months of the full revolution. Until one of the, I don't like to use the word in an anarchist context, but one of the leaders, Buenaventura Durruti, was killed in Madrid, and the funeral of Durruti. So I cover that period from the revolution on the in July, on the 19th of July, through to the 20th of November, that 4 month period.
So was the revolution something that was sort of the sandwich in between Franco and Stalin? I mean, are you one of these people that thinks that that fascism and the Soviet-style communism were two kind of similar
things?
They're
the same thing, yeah.
Were the same thing?
Yeah, well, they're very similar. You know, they're both tyrannies. They have nothing to do whatever with socialism. National socialism has nothing to do with socialism except the name. And Stalinism and even Leninism had, in my view, but I'm an anarchist, you know, it's all explained in the book if you want to read it. That's had actually nothing to do with socialism.
That's a hotly contested point, but I come across more and more people that convince me that actually there's a, it's almost like these two opposites are set up in a country that's in turmoil, and people are attracted to one side or the other, but actually the best thing to do is not to be attracted to either side.
Well,
there's
a lot
of pressure on people if you're going to fight, if there's a fight going on, to choose a side.
Well, there is, but the fight happened later. I mean, as Orwell, let's quote Orwell because everybody respects and trusts him. Orwell said the anarchists chased Franco out of Aragon. He was there shortly afterwards. He was amazed. It completely informed, in my view, the rest of his life. Orwell was an anarchist. And he was completely amazed at what he saw and heartwarmed by what he saw going on in Barcelona, which was really slightly after the high period.
Did any of these ideals last after the Spanish Civil War?
Yes. No. Okay. Some people were fighting Franco. Anarchists never gave up. They were in the hills and they fought Franco until, I think, 1967. So that was going on. The some of the ideals translated across to, for example, free school education. The modern schools of Paco Ferrer were created also in America, and I suppose Summerhill, the free school, has got a lot to do with that. The feminism of the Spanish Revolution, an organization called Mujeres Libres, Free Women. They were very, very advanced people, and we've forgotten about it. And it
What about the Pyrenees? Because I imagine that some of the sorts of ideals and ways of doing things, ways of working, might survive there. It's a little bit away from the cities and a little bit uncontrolled.
I don't think so. I think Franco really thoroughly obliterated that revolution. I do think that it possibly was the last chance for revolution in our society or in our history. I don't want to be too negative about
what
things.
Would you say were the lessons in terms of ideas, the positive ideas that came out of all that?
Well, the notion of anarchism is that you run society from the bottom without a state, without a party through civil society organizations, specifically in Spain. These were through big trade unions. So after the revolution drove the army out, people simply went back to work. They then negotiated with the bosses. A lot of them ran away to France, but some of them stayed to say, well, okay, it's fine, you can stay, you get equal pay with everybody else. We have meetings about this, and it worked fine. People say, you know, don't be under the impression that the Spanish Revolution failed because it was an idealistic utopia and those kind of things never worked. I mean, how long it would have worked is another matter, because Spain was a divided society. I suppose over 50% of the people had anarchist ideals, and they would probably have won an election. But it's very difficult to change things. But
Would it be difficult to persuade them to vote in an election as their anarchists?
Well, they had voted. They voted in some elections. They didn't vote in others. All of that was decided through meetings that were structured federally from the bottom up, and huge meetings, you know, of the trade unions, of the CNT. It was very democratic. It worked. Agricultural, for example, agricultural production went up by 30%. When the Bolsheviks, shall we call them, the communists, who are basically the bourgeoisie, agricultural production went up, industrial production improved. Ford's in Barcelona was retooled to make aircraft engines. The railways ran, the hospitals worked, everything worked. If you don't believe me, read Orwell.
What about it's a basic fact here that without the state, how on earth are you going to stop someone coming along, the next tyrant coming on, taking over? You've got to have some sort of structure to defend whatever it is you've decided you want to do, haven't you?
Well, that's the standard sort of critique of revolution, isn't it? That you either it's the notion that you have to have some kind of authoritarian government. But that wasn't the case in Spain. People organized themselves. They wanted to do it, it has to be said. And it has to be said that you wouldn't want to have been a priest. And the bourgeoisie were fine. I mean, they had their cars commandeered, but they pretty soon, as Orwell noticed, started using familiar forms of speech and dressing like workers. And they seem to have been, you know, it was a...
Why do people have it in for the priests then? Because, I mean, we've seen over the years quite often, I mean, for example, in South America, the Catholic Church has been the only conduit for human rights. Pretty much everything else has been attacking. So
absolutely,
why the priests?
So,
why?
Yeah. Well, you're talking about liberation theology, aren't you? That was a later thing. But it was definitely the case in Spain, you know, throughout the period of anarchist evolution. They called it the idea that the church and the priests, the church in particular, was solidly allied with the bourgeoisie and the ruling class. And the anarchists wanted to change everything. I mean, they didn't marry. It's in my book, if you want to read that. They didn't marry. They formalized their relationship with the trade union. I know it sounds very odd. I mean, incidentally, these were trade unions that were – I mean, one of the problems perhaps with the revolution was that the people who were running the trade union were very, very poorly paid and perhaps stronger and better people could have been found. But, I mean, that was one – that was one of the problems. The other problem was that they were extremely principled. So they had the opportunity to take over the government, and they didn't do it. They said, we're anarchists. We don't take over the government.
Well, leaving it for someone else to take it over. Franco, for example.
Well, Franco, they could have fought off. But actually what happened was that the mice came out of the woodwork. The old bourgeois government turned up again, and they started to negotiate with Stalin. They sent all of Spain's gold to Stalin, which was a bit ironic. The story is in my book, because the people that were involved in the the organisation or coordination, if you like, Durruti and Ascaso and Oliveira, those people, they had been bank robbers. So they were actually in the trade, you know. But so the gold was sent to Stalin. Stalin then assured the Spanish bourgeoisie that if they joined the Communist Party, that the Communists would basically back them up. He didn't want a revolution. He wanted to crush the revolution. So therefore, the Spanish middle classes, property classes, flooded into what had been a very tiny Stalinist Communist Party. To cut the story down a little bit, basically Stalin and everybody else armed either Franco was being armed by the fascists or the Republicans were being armed by Stalin, and both sides agreed that there would be no freedom for the workers and no revolution. There wasn't going to be a revolution. It didn't happen. And they successfully covered it up. One of the best books about the Spanish Revolution is called The Grand Camouflage by, I believe, if I can remember his name, Burnett Bolotin, who had been there. It's one of the greatest works of history. He's very well respected, you know, but he records how everybody wanted to cover it up and forget it ever happened.
You know what, this reminds me a little bit of things like Vietnam and even the situation in the Middle East with ISIS, where you've got what they call the hardening of the sides. So you get outside influences saying, well, there's this side or this side that you can be on, and really not talking about the middle, which is what most people ought to and want to be on, no?
No.
Surely, you know, most people would...
I'm not going to agree with you there.
...will be going towards either the Republican side or Franco, aren't they?
No, what happened in Spain is a lot of very, very ordinary, decent, good-hearted people rose up against fascism. As Orwell said, they drove Franco out of Aragon, and they were betrayed by all sides in the world and crushed. And it's a terrible story.
Well, somebody must have been going to Franco, and some people must have been going to the Republican side. They couldn't have done it with just people from outside Spain, surely.
No, I'm not sure of your point.
Well, I'm saying is that the main armed factions that ended up being the armed factions were those two sides. And so the people who were actually trying to create a revolution were stuck in the middle, really.
No, they weren't. They were the one side that drove Franco out. And then because they'd gained control of the street and were effectively in control of the country... The other forces in society, the property forces in society, the people that had been in government, the liberals, those people who weren't in a huge majority. I mean, they were probably 50-50, you know. But that's quite a high number if you think of people that were really committed to a total revolution was perhaps 50% of the population. It's quite massive. But the story is that the revolution, real revolution, and I think it's always the case, the same thing happened in the Soviet Union with Lenin crushing the worker collectives. Revolution isn't permissible because the state and power and authority will take over.
Anyway, the book's called The Beautiful Season, The Story of the Spanish Revolution by Bristol resident Roger Yates.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Hello, I'm Angela Balassi. I've been away for a little while, but I'm back speaking to Tony Gosling about the EU and the referendum coming up on June 23rd.
Hi, Angela.
Hello. So, firstly, Tony, would you like to tell me what your thoughts are on the whole matter?
Well, it's nice to be grilled for a change because I do most of the grilling on this show. Certainly fascinating to see all of the opinions on all different sides. I think the debate, though, is being very restricted. We've got basically two guys from the Bullingdon Club in Oxford and the Conservative Party, that is Boris Johnson and David Cameron, two Tory party leaders, on the TV most days, and it seems making all the new ground. And that is to say, the mainstream media in London, the London newspapers, the London broadcasters, are all seem to be reacting to whatever it is that David Cameron and Boris Johnson are saying. So they're kind of controlling the debate. There's a lot that hasn't really been talked about, and the most important things haven't been talked about. The two I would identify really as, firstly, the origins of the EU. Where did these ideas come from? This enormous great bureaucracy didn't come from nowhere. So looking at the origins, and then also looking at how the democratic checks and balances. Is this the sort of bureaucracy that could be made to work? Does it actually reflect the views of ordinary people, or is it a kind of bureaucratic dictatorship? So those are the two things I think have just not been included in the discussion or debate at all, and they're both extremely important.
Okay, so let's start with the origins.
The origins, now there's lots of different people saying lots of different things about this, but my assessment of it is you have to go back to around about 1942 to look at something called the Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft documents, which were produced in Nazi Germany, in Berlin. And they were effectively trying to, I mean, they were looking at ways of running occupied Europe, because the Nazis had already overrun many countries. Obviously, the Poland and Czechoslovakia were the first. And they wanted ways to integrate those into the greater Germany. Hitler had a vision for the Third Reich, a thousand-year Reich, which would be called Fortress Europe, Festung Europa, which was a whole continent run from Berlin. And the big question was, how were the local areas going to be given some degree of autonomy, factories going to integrate into the German economic system? Now, Germany had been run really most of the time between the wars and up to the war on a cartel system, which was where the big industries, the big leaders of industry, as we know the oil companies do now, all get together and basically fix prices and decide on how the market's going to run. And people don't understand how this system worked. One of the most famous cartels was IG Farben. I mean, it was an enormous great organization that made things. It was doing chemicals, but it was really a top down structure that had managed to pretty much monopolize all the markets that it was in. So it would do things like buy up its competition just to close them down, a bit like what's happening in effectively now in Port Talbot with the steelworks. You've got Tata Steel have got owned many steel plants around the world, but the two most locally to us are this place called IJmuiden in Holland and Port Talbot. Now, actually, Tata wants to close Port Talbot down because there's a lack of demand for steel, and it doesn't want someone else buying up that plant, which would then start to compete with its Dutch plant. So that was effectively the system that they ran in Germany, which was buying up all of the industry in a certain industry and then fixing the prices. Of course, the public doesn't benefit from that. And that's what they wanted to introduce right across Europe. The other thing to mention is that Deutsche Bank and other big German banks had been buying stock up in other banks in other parts of Europe. And those banks, of course, had been making loans to industries around those individual countries. And by buying up the stock in the banks, the German banks were actually secretly, quietly, behind the scenes, like almost a shell company, buying up large amounts of industry in the countries they'd already occupied or were about to occupy. So the Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft, just translated into English, European Economic Community, documents from 1942 are really about an occupied Europe. Now, obviously, the Nazis officially lost in 1945. They were overrun by the Russians. Worth saying here that D-Day in 1944 was really with the Allies, the Americans and the British, landing in France to stop the Russians winning the war on their own, because they had taken by far the most massive number of casualties in defeating Hitler, not us. And so the idea really being that, well, we could still have this system, German industry could still be in control after the war, so long as we squirrel away, secrete all the wealth that we've gained from Europe. This is one of the first things that the Nazis did when they went into a country, is they looted the central bank, took all the valuables, back to Berlin. But then once they realised they were going to lose the war, those valuables were secreted around the world. They didn't have too far to go to Switzerland, you know. And of course, the Swiss were making a lot of money out of the Second World War as well. So they were happy to cooperate. So that's really the origins, I think, of the whole idea of a European Economic Community, which Britain joined in 1973. And then I think it was about 1983, not sure of the exact date, but anyway, after Margaret Thatcher resigned, the Maastricht Treaty was signed and we entered the European Union proper.
Okay. Well, Boris Johnson has compared the EU's aims to those of Hitler's. What are your thoughts on that?
Well,
then, given
historically, he's quite right. I mean, I think we've seen over the years the Western world, I'm talking about right way back to Napoleon, and has been trying to do its best to take over Russia, to force the Russians to kind of integrate into our Western power system. The things like the euro, of course, has been massively successful in integrating various different countries towards the EU because, of course, they're dependent on the European Central Bank for almost everything they do now through loans. And, I mean, the IMF have been doing over the years, anybody that's in a position where they have to go to somebody in order to carry on, to renew a loan or to extend a loan, they're in a very weak position politically. And that's what happened to most of the countries in Southern Europe. Luckily, Britain stayed out of it. And I just think, you know, politically, the actual amount of reflection of ordinary people's views going on in Brussels is just about zero. I mean, it's all run by big corporations. Just look around you. You can see the big chains, the multinationals in our high streets are thriving whilst lots of small businesses are going to the wall.
Okay, but on the other hand, you have Hilary Benn, the shadow foreign secretary, who's obviously in favour. He says it's an unfair comparison. The EU doesn't involve genocide, for example.
Well, no, but actually there are some similarities because the European Union has supported the coup in 2014 in Ukraine and the overturning of the Russian influence in Ukraine. And actually, if you have a look there, you'll see there are some pretty obnoxious far-right. And I wouldn't even call them neo-Nazis. These people are Nazis in Ukraine, some of them. They've got pictures of Nazi war heroes on the walls of their offices in their political parties. They have songs based around this guy, Stefan Bandera, who was very much basically a kind of little agent for Hitler in Ukraine. And you can sort of understand it because they've lived for a long time, Ukraine, under the Soviet influence and the Moscow influence. So they see Russia and Moscow as the bad guys. But having said that, you look at the rise of the far right in Europe, particularly with the migration crisis, and it's not surprising in a way that you've got far right groups cropping up. The trouble is there isn't really any effort by Brussels to stamp this out and to stop it thriving. So we're in a very worrying time. And of course, fascism thrives when you've got big inequalities, and those big inequalities are widening in Europe. You've got two major problems. One is the migration crisis, they call it. That is effectively bringing lots and lots of cheap labour in to Europe. And undermining pay and conditions of people who are already here. So there's a lot of people nervous about that. And it's causing a lot of disruption and stress on services. But also the financial crisis over the last sort of 15 or so years, slowly but surely, the euro has been killing off a lot of industries in the continent. And so people are just looking at Brussels and say, why on earth would we want anything to do with that? You brought us these crises. You're not solving them. You're not sorting them out. You're a massive bureaucracy. You've got nothing to do with ordinary people. And you're just running the whole continent now, 500 million people. Look, let's not forget, United States is about 230 million. But we're getting a United States of Europe of 500 million, which would be even bigger than the United States. And if you want to look at how democracy is done in the United States of America, just look at this presidential contest this year between two maniacs, basically this Islamophobic Trump and Hillary Hillary Clinton, who's been involved in all sorts of certainly very strong evidence that she's been involved in war crimes over the years in allowing the Libyan sarin gas to go into Syria for the Ghouta chemical weapons attack back in 2014. Hillary Clinton is a really dangerous person. So you've got two completely dangerous maniacs running for president. That's not democracy. And that's what we've got in America. And we've got the possibility of something even worse happening in Europe with 500 million people. So for me, it's a bit of a no-brainer, this whole Brexit thing.
I suppose that brings us to your second point about checks and balances. What are the issues surrounding that?
Well, look, we all elect MEPs, don't we? But if you talk to any of these MEPs, any honest ones anyway, they'll tell you, well, we get our expenses, it's all very nice. We live in this kind of amazing cocoon in the middle of Brussels where we've got our own shopping centres. If there's riots outside, we don't even see them. You know, we're all sealed off and everything from it. And any of the honest ones will tell you they've got no power. They've got no power. They can talk. And one of the reasons that you don't get much news coverage of how it all works in Brussels is because what they're doing is usually it's only temporarily slowing things down. If there's something that's really awful for the continent, the MEPs have got very little power. It just comes back in a different form. The idea that the legislation, new laws are being drawn up by commissioners who no one's elected through the European Commission, the MPs, all they can do is kind of slow that process down. And let's not forget who these commissioners are. Almost all of them are failed politicians. That is, people who've been voted out by the public right across Europe are then given new jobs as commissioners running the whole show, which is really perverse.
Okay, coming back to influence, the UK, how much influence does it have? I understand it's a big contributor when it comes to the financial side, but how much influence do you think it has?
Well, influence very little. I mean, we've seen this year with David Cameron's much trumpeted trip to Brussels to see Hollande and Merkel, the French and German leaders, to try and twist a little bit more for Britain out of the political side of the EU is a complete failure. He's come back with virtually nothing at all. And that's because the way that the European Union is going to be run, and Europe, apparently, the EU anyway, is going to be run, has already been decided behind closed doors. This is the problem, isn't it? That we don't have any actual real input anymore. And I suppose there's quite a few people that voted not to join the EEC back in the 1970s who just point the finger and say, well, look, this is exactly what we warned you of. And it's turned out to be a big business run, elite run, plutocrat run, banker run, bureaucracy, just like we said it would be.
Okay, but there must be some benefits.
Oh, difficult to see. I mean, I suppose things like ease of travel might be one. But then, hang on, you could do that before anyway. It was no real problem going to Italy, France, or to continental Europe beforehand. I can't see a lot of real benefits. I mean, the obvious thing to say is look at Britain. 1973, we were one of the biggest industrial nations in the world. Certainly, we had full employment. If your boss messed you about, you could just walk out the door the next day and get a job somewhere else. And you got well paid as well. It wasn't as if you have to have both husband and wife, both partners working in order to pay the rent. And you could have a decent life with only one person in the household going to work, and you could leave your job. This is really important. If you know, nobody wants to work for an idiot of a boss, and I'm sure there are people listening out there who've had to do that. I certainly have. And if you're in a situation of full employment, it's really good. It's really easy. You can go and get another job straight away. But of course, big business doesn't like that. It likes to be able to corral its workforce and bully them. And they can only do that if you've got a situation of structural unemployment, which is what we've had really ever since about 1980, after we joined the EU. So all I'm saying is, I think, you know, we can rearrange things to make them much better for a lot more people if we actually get our sovereignty back and we can start doing things for ourselves. Because at the moment, many of the big decisions to do with borders and economic policy are basically told us by Brussels. Say for example, we want a new contract for the city council. We can't employ local people. We've got to have an open free tender. And it might be that a French company, a German company, Italian company come in with a loss leader and just undercut all the local competition. We put loads of local people out of work. And the most important thing to understand about all this is that in industry, the control is abroad and the profits go abroad. So if we have, a car factory like Honda's in Swindon, which starts doing really well, the money doesn't stay in Swindon. It goes off to Japan or wherever else it happens to be. And we're in also a crazy situation where so much of our car industry and things like aviation, aircraft fabrication, we don't do any of that anymore. We don't make any aircraft here at all. So all the heavy industry's gone. And you know what that also means? Our ability to fight has also gone, because we can't build things like aeroplanes, tanks, whatever it is. If we had to fight, it's become much more dangerous and much more difficult to do so because we've been cleaned out.
So why would people want to stay in the EU?
I think most people do because they see it as, I mean, there's a lot of spin, isn't there, around Europe. We want to stay in Europe. It's not Europe, it's the EU. And sensible countries in Europe have not joined the European Union, the political side of things. Norway, very successful country outside the EU with its own sovereign wealth fund through the oil. For example, also Switzerland. Don't tell me the Swiss aren't successful. They are. And these countries haven't joined. They haven't been strong-armed into joining. And I think there's loads. I mean, literally, okay, we've got 500 million people in Europe. I think there's probably about 300 to 400 million of those people looking at Britain and saying, come on, send a very strong message to Brussels that this isn't working for us. Because certainly right across places like Greece and Italy and Spain, the EU has been a total economic disaster. And in a way, the euro and joining the eurozone has been an enormous financial con trick where people have just been bamboozled. And it's time we woke up to that.
If we didn't have the currency, would that make any difference? Do you think it's possible to have an EU without sharing the currency as we have done?
Well, we haven't here in Britain. You know, we've got our pound still. But the two things are very closely linked because it's an attempt to create I suppose it's not really a United States of Europe. It's one country with its financial and industrial might, I suppose, direction outside Britain. So we would have to do what we're told. And the only way we've managed to retain some kind of control over what's happened in the British Isles is because we kept the pound. And you can see what's happened elsewhere with the euro currency.
Well, given that, why do we still have limited influence?
I think who's running the show is you have to look at the European Roundtable of Industrialists and the people that feed in the new legislation, the new laws into the European Commission. They're running the show, the big multinationals, and any idea you might have about the EU being a counterbalance to the United States is rubbish, because the same big companies are very influential, powerful, both in America and in the European Roundtable of Industrialists and in Brussels. So it's a kind of illusion. You know, I look at quite a lot of the conflicts in the world, and you see the Americans being gung-ho and you see Merkel and the Europeans being more reasonable. But actually it's more like a good cop, bad cop approach. Both of them are two hands on the same body.
Okay. And what do you think of Barack Obama's influence?
Well, what's it got to do with him? I mean, look, these people are globalists. The American presidents, really ever since Kennedy was assassinated, have just been representatives of big business and the military-industrial complex. So if they want us to do something, I would just do the opposite.
Okay, so if we were to leave, what's the alternative?
Well, we'll be, I suppose, in a much weaker position than we were in the early 1970s, but at least we'll be in command of our own fate and our own destiny, I hope. You know, that's the main thing we need to do. And I think it's also worth mentioning that you've got secessionist movements right across Europe, and Catalonia's been desperate to get away from Brussels, desperate to get away from Spain. In Venice, they're trying to do the same, to get away from Italy. And that's because it's not working for ordinary people anymore. So it's about time the plutocrats at the top, who've been running the whole show for their own personal private benefit and their own personal private gain, we got a strong signal to say, no, you're not doing this anymore. And I think Brexit may be that.
Okay, thank you, Tony.
Thanks, Angela.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Now time for the second part of my interview with Alex Pascal. We had the first part last week, but this time he tells us a little bit more about his experience broadcasting across London in the 1970s and 1980s and through the Brixton riots, and also in an encounter with Peter Tosh.
The government here, or governments, are playing games between the Asian community and the black community, the ones who have the money and those who they think will give problems. We cannot build a nation like that.
I think there's a lot of super wealthy, if you want to call them the 0.1% or something, that actually rather like to see, Alex, white and black and grey and every type of colour fighting each other, so long as they're poor.
Yeah, we even have to go back to analyse this words black and white. I wouldn't go into it now, but it's a big analysis. That's why in my terminology I speak of black, white and indifferent, because you will get that form on all sides. And as long as we work in this two colour, it's like the two parties of Britain or the two parties of the world. The ones in America are no different. We need a real political change. And I'm coming to why now that I have written this song, Vote. I remember when asked in 1981, the BBC was doing something about a question of numbers. And I was asked to write a song and be part of this program. I wrote the song called The Streets Are Paved With Gold. And then I took no part in the television program because then they Powellized it. Powell just became it. Then when the winter of discontent came in 1974, I looked again at what was happening. Even toilet paper we couldn't buy, if you remember. And I wrote Minor Pains and Labour Pains. Mr. Heath had minor pains. Mr. Wilson had labour pains. The Liberals were neither up or down, and the whole goddamn country was falling down. What is different in this current period? Absolutely nothing. Then I went to Cardiff and the people wouldn't vote up there, and I wrote, vote him in, vote him out. After that, in 1983, for the general election, I wrote, vote, use your vote. The very one now that I have edited, taking no sides, that's how little objectivity could come back here, but to write a song to encourage people in Britain, in whatever elections there is, to come out and use your vote. We have to do that to make our point and change things until some new form of voting system come about.
Well, look, but many people, particularly poorer people, will say, well, it makes no difference which way I vote. You still get the same. You've got a permanent government.
Shall I tell you something? They're right. They are right. But what do we do? We just cannot sit back like that. And because we have this people who will bus people into places just to win the election. You see, it's not about the people. It's about, at this moment in Britain, Cameron is fighting Boris because they both want power. In America, Trump has the money, so he's fighting Hillary. And what I cannot get to is how people would push their hands in their pockets, take out money to support these guys in billions, rally for them through the rain, the snow, and in the end, we can't tell them what to do. So something has gone wrong in the world overall. It's in Britain, it's in Europe, it's in the United States, it's in China. It's not one thing. The world has to come alive.
Yes, but I mean, you know as well as I do, as radio hosts, it's part of our job, is you can't just curse the darkness, you've got to light a lamp. So what's your, I know it's a bit of a tall order, but what's your solution?
My solution is that let's come back to where people can sit down away from what is called journalism. I did civics at school. We should teach citizens, not the way they want to teach citizens now, citizenship in school. They don't want any political thing in it. There must be trends where we teach young people to understand and respect the communities from now. That is not in the national curriculum. And if even though it's possibly put there under citizenship, you cannot be seen. Otherwise, you would be told that you're politicizing the children. What's wrong about politicizing the children? You have to vote later on. So just when you reach 16, they're ready for your vote and you know nothing. That's where the ignorance comes in. So we people, as the media persons, should try to, in whatever way we can as communicators, bring facts. There are three sides to every story: yours, mine, and the facts.
Well, look, let's wind back to your days at Radio London, Black Londoners. Were there ever any moments there when you got a caller in talking to the city where you really thought, crikey, this is, I don't know quite how I'm going to handle this?
Oh, look, there were many moments like that. There were moments like that with musicians. I remember Peter Tosh was a wonderful guy. I really missed him. And the days when he just would talk about ganja and everybody would squirm, you know. And Peter was at some concert in Finsbury Park where the people had a go at him. And the next day I was supposed to interview him. And people were always telling me, you should never interview Peter Tosh live. And I said, why? Oh, Alex, he's not an easy guy. He came along. And I could feel by the shake of his hands that he wasn't settled. Put on three records in advance, and I said to the people, just as I put on the first one, the man you have been waiting for, I've got him here, he's in the studio with me. I'm trying that time to measure him out. He sat down in front of me, and I said, hi, Peter, it's nice to be here with you, and so on. And he said, oh, that's the way he speaks. And then I said, Peter, why is it always that people having a go at you? And he says to me, Alex, just before I man come here, I'd seen, I was looking at a film, a scene, and I see this star boy, with both of them white, and one running away from the other, and all at once the woman stand up and the man stand up, and he said, I didn't come here to F you for money, you know, I just come here to F you for love. Now, at that moment, with a black program, and you have those words going out, I looked at Keith, who was the producer. I saw all the six lines lit up, and I said, Jesus Christ, I could feel my seat, it must be wet. And Peter just comfortable. And I went out, I put on a record to see him out, and I looked by Keith, and Keith says to me, I said, Keith, what's all this? The calls you're getting. He says to me, people are asking when you're going to repeat that again. Because the youngsters were all there. And people who knew Peter Tosh wanted to hear him. They didn't care what he said. That was a tight moment.
I bet, yeah. I mean, that sort of stuff, you could very easily get complaints, swearing. But it's not, you know, it's not a ringing endorsement of somebody like him to be known for the man that swears live on the radio.
The Brixton Riots was the next one. That was real tough, you know. Robbie wouldn't go down there. None of the white guys in the newsroom would go down there at all. And when I asked the manager for the car, they were worried that it would get broken. And I remember the manager saying, so is the car more expensive than the life of Alex Pascoe? And then we took a cab first. I went down, and Railton Road was pretty tough. And I said to Juliet, she was with me that time, she was hanging on my coat and saying, Pascal, don't go in there. But the guys knew me because of some ex-prisoners knew me. I used to always close my program by saying to you and those behind closed doors, good night. And they felt I was talking to them. And I'll get letters from them saying, don't forget us, Alex. And the system thought that I was dealing with the prisoners. And I had to remind the deputy manager of BBC Radio London that you are locked in behind your own door as a lonely person, and that is behind closed doors. So one had the answers to what it was all about, different to what people were thinking of. And I remember him holding my hand, one of the guys, ex-guys, bringing me into this house where all the guys were, who were very bitter. And when they saw the microphone with it with BBC around the head, they said, the bad words were just coming out like bullets. And I had to stop the guys and say, fellas, I got to go back to broadcasters. And if you say that, all they were telling me is to tell Maggie Thatcher this, that, and the other. And the guy who was bringing me and say, do you all know who this man is? And he's the man that will say to you and those behind closed doors, good night. Jesus, you should see those fellas jump up. Well, even that, Alex, you better take the message back as we give you, otherwise do come back to Brixton again. That's a tall order for that period. I went back to the station, and Derek Amo was the manager, and he said to me, have you got anything? I said, yes. He said, I'd like to hear it. And I decided, no, I don't. Wouldn't let him hear that. And I waited till the program was on, and I knew people were listening, because the news were very negative from one side, even from the Beam coming out of Brixton. And I knew the people depended on me to put it as it is. And brother, I handed it to the SA, and I said, don't matter who asks you, don't hand over that tape. I point you, and then you drop it in. And I remember going on air and saying, for all those of you, words to that effect, who's quite relaxed at home and want to know what the temperature is like, that's it. And the first words that came out were four letters and so on. And the door of the newsroom pitched open, Studio One. And Derek ran in and he said, you bastard, you got him, you got him, you got him. So I was worried. And then afterwards I spoke to him and he says, the only time you could use material like that, which is right, is during times like these. So I learned on my feet.
Fascinating, Alex. Where can people find your music and your work? I suppose online it is these days.
Through the internet radio I have just created, we have a website, goodvibesradio.com. And we are developing this slowly so that it would take lots of the things that I've written, material from my archive of the many years and so, but for the radio program, I'm building it slowly, goodvibesradio.co.uk, and people could pick it up. Otherwise, my email, gvrm@email.com, they could do that. And just to come back on that song that we've been doing, how you like it yourself, personally, what do you think about it?
Sorry, me?
Yeah.
I haven't heard it.
Oh, you have? Yeah.
Sorry.
You got it?
I haven't heard it.
Oh, I see.
I mean, what we're planning to do is just to play it after we finish with you. Oh, but, you
okay,
know.
Well, the song really speaks for itself. What it's saying to people is get out, get out, get out, get up and vote. I don't care who you vote for, although I have to make it quite clear. I'm staying in. Those who want to stay out, they can stay out. You can't sit on the fence. I am staying in because Britain, the country that we live in, needs to get better. Europe is the family that we have around us, and therefore we cannot neglect a family that is so close.
Okay, but for a bit of balance, I'll say it's not Europe, it's the EU, and quite a lot of Europeans are not in the EU, people like the Swiss, the Norwegians. And actually, if you look at the well-being in Switzerland and Norway, it's quite positive, it's quite good, and there are a lot of people, I think, are to be balanced here, who would point to the industrial and the employment decline, the wages decline in Britain since the 1970s, the power of the unions declining since we joined the EU. So there's a bit of balance. But yes, yeah, you're absolutely right. People have got to go out and vote. This is probably the most important vote for 40 years at least, maybe even longer since the Second World War.
This is so serious. It is as serious as what has to happen in America. Could you imagine a guy like Trump in America becoming the president of the United States? My goodness, God. Could you imagine Boris becoming the prime minister in this country? That would be hell.
I suppose we could finish by at least I could implore you to talk to your listeners in London and let them know that we have actually got a black mayor here in Bristol now and a Labour mayor, because most of the people in the country simply miss that whole.
Tony, this is marvelous, because not that, and we have the guy who Leicester Football Club, not the manager. We have the. He's the team manager, the captain of the team of Leicester. He's likewise of Caribbean descent and quite a lovely person. So in lots of aspects, the young people who are here are making these changes.
It's amazing. I've been talking to people in different parts of the country, and certainly it hasn't got through the national news, really, that Marvin Rees was elected here in Bristol a Labour mayor and removed a former merchant venturer, you know, the slave trading club here in Bristol that seems to own the city mostly, still, even hundreds of years after the slave trade. And the people that financed and were involved with the reconnaissance trip to North America, which, you know, you have to just remind everyone of this, is 15 million or so Native Americans slaughtered after that reconnaissance over 150 years or so. A lot to answer for these rich Bristolians and their little adventures over the years. But anyway, I'll just leave the last word for you, Alex.
Tony, what is happening here is that the type of radio you're doing, the type of radio I'm doing, it's not on the surface, but its messages is what is the messages are what are necessary to go out, because the real media that we call the media here, radio and television, is gone so confused and so led that they cannot speak about things openly as we are talking about it now, with the hope of changing things.
But it's interesting, isn't it, the way that that London has voted, really ignoring the London media.
The media in London, if we had followed it, it would be as bad as what happened in Hillsborough when the guy in the Sun wrote this thing and trying to deny it. Now, it's so interesting. And whatever we do, somehow or the other, we have to take responsibility for it sooner than later. And it's best for somebody to be able to say something to you on the street than to throw a stone and hit you. it's so true. Yeah. Even though somebody wants to tell you off, it's part of the media.
Absolutely right. And confrontation is part of the media. Controversy is part of the media.
It's part of the media.
And let's have some extreme views. Why not?
I think we're seeing that there is a change to come. Lastly here, I want to say to people, although we are dissatisfied with the BBC and this whole change that has to come about with the BBC, with the renewal of its charter, we still cannot afford to lose the BBC.
No, you're right. Yeah.
Because if we were to lose the BBC, we're losing it only through the fault of those on the upper tier who carve things out so that when they're gone or thrown out, they can come on the corner, form companies, and therefore benefit out of it. That's not what we want with public broadcasting. We have to save the BBC. I have my thing with them. I'm sure you do yourself.
Yes.
But we cannot afford to allow the BBC to die.
Alex, just remind us of your radio, the website. That's
my station is called Good Vibes Radio, and my program is called Alex Pascal's Londoners. And one of the tunes that really tells them about London, apart from the vote one you're going to play, is called London City. I wrote it. And Arrow has recorded it. But that's another beautiful thing. I'm looking at London. It's a city I've lived in. It's a city I studied before coming to the United Kingdom. And therefore, on the crossroads of the world, I think we should really love this city.
Okay, Alex Pascal, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
That was Alex Pascal there, Britain's first black broadcaster. And he broadcast over Radio London in the 1970s. And 1980s, and through the Brixton riots. And you'll find Alex Pascal, OBE, online these days at goodvibesonline.co.uk and goodvibesradio.co.uk. Only on the internet. What a shame. Come on, BBC. Get him back on the airwaves. That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, local anarchist Roger Yates, who wrote in The Beautiful Season, the story of the Spanish Civil War. Also, Angela Balassi, who grilled me about the EU, its democracy and its history. And finally there, Britain's first black broadcaster, Alex Pascal, talking about Peter Tosh, amongst other things. And, of course, studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Just get hold of us through People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. You can call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So, until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
You'll hear more from this LP, no doubt of that. That's The Wake, or are they just called Wake now? No, it's still The Wake. The LP is called Tidal Wave of Hype on Sarah Records, and that was Provincial Disco.